This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Greetings, listeners. For Radio Reading Services, I am Greg Salins reading the Wall Street Journal for Friday, May 10th, 2024. There are six stories on today's front page. First, Biden's threat to freeze some weapons deliveries raises alarm in Israel. Buybacks are back. Corporate America is on a spending spree. America has too many schools. Binance pledged to thwart suspicious trading until it involved a Lamborghini-loving high roller. Hospitals are refusing to do surgeries unless you pay in full first. And when did minor league baseball get raunchy? Our first story? Biden's threat to freeze some weapons deliveries raises alarm in Israel. This article is by Jared Malson and Annette Pallad in Tel Aviv. President Biden's threat to withhold some weapons deliveries to Israel set up a high-stakes showdown with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and raised alarms in the country about a rupture in relations with its most important international supporter. Israeli officials and analysts said Biden's warning appeared to be a political message that in the short term wouldn't affect Israel's ability to wage war. But the country's long-term ability to fight on several fronts could be threatened if the U.S. president followed through on his threat to pause more weapons deliveries if Israel launches a major assault in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering there from the war. The pause risks one of the worst crises ever in Israeli-American relations, drawing comparisons to President Ronald Reagan's decision to delay delivery of F-16 jet fighters to Israel during its bombardment of Beirut in 1981. Netanyahu responded to Biden in a video message released on Thursday, saying, "If we need to stand alone, we will stand alone. As I've already said, we will fight with our fingernails." Israel's war and security cabinets met Thursday evening and discussed Israel's response to the U.S. decision to withhold munitions, according to an Israeli official. "The Biden administration's stance is very unfortunate. I think it sends the wrong message to Hamas and to our enemies in the region," Michael Herzog, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., said in an online appearance organized by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. "Nobody presented to me or to us a strategy of defeating Hamas without dealing with Rafah. I've not seen it," Herzog said. Biden's threat led the Israeli news agenda on Thursday, with most reporters and analysts conveying alarm over the pause and characterizing it as U.S. frustration with Israel's management of the war, a sign of deteriorating relations, and a warning to Netanyahu. Others, including Netanyahu's supporters, were angry at the Biden administration for failing to fully support Israel in reaching its war goals and constraining the prime minister's actions after 7 months of war. "Certainly the defense establishment is horrified by this," said Chuck Freilich, a former deputy national security advisor in Israel. "The importance here, at least for the short term, is the political statement. It won't have a military impact on operations in Gaza. It could if there's a major outbreak of fighting with Hezbollah." Israel has been fighting a slow-burning conflict with Lebanon's Hezbollah movement since the war against Hamas in Gaza began in October. It holds in reserve supplies of munitions for a possible full-scale war with Lebanon, but has already drawn weapons from those stocks during the war in Gaza, the Wall Street Journal has previously reported. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant implicitly addressed the U.S. as part of the speech he gave on Thursday. "I turn to Israel's enemies as well as to our best of friends and say the state of Israel cannot be subdued, not the IDF, not the defense establishment, and not the state of Israel. We will stand strong, we will achieve our goals," he said. "Hamas loves Biden," Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said on X using a heart emoji. Other members of Netanyahu's governing coalition responded with anger at Biden. At the same time, the divisions in Israeli politics and society were reflected in the reactions to the U.S. move. Benny Gantz, a member of the Israeli War Cabinet, who is also a Netanyahu rival, said the United States stood by Israel at its most difficult hour, and the attack on it by ministers is irresponsible and ungrateful, aimed at domestic purposes from political considerations. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said the British government also didn't support a major invasion of Rafah without a plan to protect civilians, but it wouldn't follow the U.S. in cutting weapons supplies to Israel. Cameron, taking questions at the end of a foreign policy speech in London on Thursday, noted that the U.K. wasn't a major supplier of weapons to Israel, providing less than 1% of the country's needs. Israeli forces seized control of the Gaza side of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt earlier this week, sparking battles with Palestinian fighters as it pressed forward in the area in what it called a limited operation. On Thursday, the Israeli military said that 50 militants were killed and 10 tunnel shafts discovered during its continuing operation in Rafah this week. Meanwhile, negotiations continued Thursday towards a possible ceasefire deal that would free Israeli hostages held by Hamas, according to officials familiar with the talks. Central Intelligence Agency Director William Burns has been in the region in recent days in an effort to push the negotiations forward after months of gridlock. Negotiators left Cairo and are expected to return to the Egyptian capital by Tuesday. Biden said in an interview with CNN that aired on Wednesday night in the U.S. that he would refuse to send more bombs and artillery shells to Israel if it proceeds with an operation in Rafah. The warning came after he decided to put on hold the delivery of a shipment of 2,500-pound bombs, the first time he has chosen to withhold the supply of the types of weapons that Israel uses in Gaza. The U.S. has cautioned Israel against a major ground operation in Rafah, and Biden believes it would be a strategic mistake. John Kirby, a spokesman for the National Security Council, said on Thursday, "If they do smash into Rafah, go in and invade in a major way, then he's going to have to make future decisions," Kirby said of Biden. The question now is how Netanyahu responds to Biden's ultimatum. The Israeli prime minister for months has argued that attacking Rafah and destroying Hamas's remaining forces there is necessary to quash the militant group. Bibi thinks that this is just a yellow card and that the red card will never arrive, said Amit Segal, a right-wing political commentator on Israel's Channel 12 News, referring to Netanyahu by his widely used nickname. Netanyahu believes Biden won't go as far as stopping weapons shipments to Israel due to the weight of conservative and Jewish voters in the U.S. leading up to the presidential elections, said Segal. Israeli and U.S. intelligence officials say that destroying Hamas totally is likely out of reach, with or without the Rafah operation. Western officials and the UN have warned that a large-scale attack on Rafah would result in widespread death and destruction among the Palestinian civilians who are sheltering in the area, including many who have fled there from the northern Gaza Strip. The Biden administration faces decisions about future weapons transfers. The administration is currently considering the transfer of more than $1 billion in new weapons for Israel, including tank ammunition, military vehicles, and mortar rounds, the Journal has reported. The State Department is also reviewing a separate deal for precision weapons for Israel. The administration could decide to hold those weapons deals if Netanyahu proceeds with an attack on Rafah. If Washington were to proceed with them, it would have to seek approval from key leaders in Congress, where it would face strong opposition from Democrats who want the administration to use weapons sales to coerce changes in Israeli policy. The administration is also facing criticism from Republicans in Congress who oppose conditioning military aid. The decision to hold back one weapons delivery was a small warning shot to Israel, yes, but not at all a shift in policy, said a senior U.S. congressional aide. The U.S. sent tens of thousands of bombs, artillery shells, and other munitions to Israel in the initial months of the war. Most of those weapons came from previously approved U.S. military sales, most of them paid for by billions of dollars in American government funding to support Israel. Washington organized more than 100 individual arms transfers to Israel. Separately, Congress last month passed a bill to provide an additional $26 billion in assistance for Israel, including more than $5 billion to replenish Israel's air defenses. Biden signed the bill, along with separate measures to send weapons to Ukraine and Taiwan, in late April. Our next story. Buybacks are back. Corporate America is on a spending spree. This article is by Charlie Grant. U.S. companies are feeling good about their prospects and spending like they mean it. Their first quarter earnings season is turning out better than many Wall Street forecasters had expected. At the same time, companies are stepping up repurchases of their own shares, which is giving a resurgent stock market an extra boost. S&P 500 companies that have reported first quarter results as of Monday have disclosed buying back $181.2 billion of their shares during the period, according to data compiled by Birrenell Associates. That is up 16% from the year-ago quarter, and the pace of purchases has been brisker than usual for 9 straight weeks, Bank of America Securities said Wednesday in a research note. Big tech companies are leading the charge. Facebook's parent Meta Platforms repurchased $14.5 billion of its shares in the first quarter, up about $5 billion from a year earlier. Apple, Netflix, and Nvidia are among the other companies that have stepped up buybacks, as well as Wells Fargo, the construction equipment maker Caterpillar, and the tobacco manufacturer Altria Group. The spending is expected to continue. Apple shares had their best day since 2022 on Friday, after the tech company says it plans to buy back $110 billion of its own stock. In all, 443 companies have announced a buyback plan this year, up from 378 a year earlier, data from Birrenell shows. Investors are taking the increase in buybacks as a sign of rising confidence among executives, despite persistent fears that the economy could weaken or that interest rates will stay high for longer than hoped. Corporate America thinks their fundamentals are fine. They're not worried about rates, not worried about their balance sheets, said Jeffrey Yale Rubin, president of Birrenell Associates. If people that know the companies the closest are comfortable buying the stock, why shouldn't I be? The S&P 500 has advanced 9.3% this year. That includes a 3.5% rally so far in May, which marks the best start to the month since 2009. The jump in buybacks so far this year comes after a sharp pullback in 2023, when repurchases by S&P 500 companies tumbled 14%. That was the second largest annual decline since the global financial crisis in 2008, and came in the midst of fears that high interest rates could tip the economy into recession. Some companies raced to buy back stock in 2022 before a new 1% buyback tax went into effect last year. Instead, the economy has remained strong, defying skeptics. Earnings growth has resumed, and Wall Street analysts expect growth to pick up steam through the rest of the year. And while interest rates remain at their highest levels in more than two decades, the extra yield over treasuries that investors demand to lend to bigger companies is near multi-decade lows. Analysts at Goldman Sachs project that total S&P 500 repurchases will reach $925 billion this year and $1.075 trillion in 2025, which would mark annual growth rates of 13% and 16% respectively. Buybacks are popular among investors because they lower the number of shares outstanding, boosting a company's per-share earnings. Meta stock surged 23%, its best day in nearly a decade, after it unveiled a $50 billion buyback plan in February. Share repurchases are a relatively flexible use of cash. They can typically take place at a company's discretion without a fixed deadline. Other uses of cash, such as investing in a new factory or paying out a regular dividend, are much harder to stop if the economy sours. Investors usually owe taxes on dividend payments they receive. Large repurchases can make stocks more attractive, but some investors warn they aren't a reason for buying on their own. Buybacks can signal a slowing business, as fast-growing companies often invest their cash back into expanding their operations. Buybacks should be one element of an overarching strategy to boost shareholder return, said Tim Thomas, Director of Research and Wealth Manager at Badgley Phelps. Large repurchases won't lift stocks in companies that aren't increasing revenue or finding other useful ways to invest their cash, he said. Major tech companies are among the largest buyers of their own stock, but they are also spending big in other areas. Meta and Google's parent, Alphabet, both initiated a dividend for the first time this year, meaning five of the so-called Magnificent Seven now pay one. That is on top of the billions of dollars many tech companies say they plan to spend every quarter to develop artificial intelligence capabilities. Taken together, it is why the spending decisions are reassuring, said Sarah Kanwal, Managing Director of Equities at Crestwood Advisors. They're not pulling back on investments. Our next story. America has too many schools. This article is by Sarah Randazzo and Matt Barnum in Los Angeles. In a huge city awash with tiny schools, few are smaller than the Hilda L. Solis Learning Academy. The public high school, housed in a former hospital in East Los Angeles, is down to 170 students from the surrounding Latino neighborhoods. On a hallway bulletin board, handwritten hearts display reasons students love the school, including how everyone knows each other and the fact that the school is small. The school's size, beloved by many families, will also be its demise. Los Angeles Unified School District is closing Solis this summer, citing declining enrollment that has severely limited the school's offerings. Students can take basic classes needed to graduate, but have few options for electives or advanced coursework. The only after-school activities are weightlifting and a Bible club. I know financially the district can't afford this. I see how much our enrollment has dropped, math teacher Melina Gutierrez said, tears welling in her eyes on a recent day as she looked around her longtime classroom. But the small school is a great thing for kids. Solis's closure is an omen of what could be coming to more schools in Los Angeles and cities across the country. And it reflects a difficult-to-sustain dynamic. Too many schools for too few students. As birth rates have dipped, families have moved elsewhere, and public school alternatives have grown, many urban districts have hemorrhaged students. That has left officials with the difficult choice of keeping open shrinking schools with resources spread thin or shutting them down, a move that inevitably garners fierce community backlash. How school leaders navigate this challenge could define urban school systems for the next several years. The pandemic accelerated trends that were already in motion in some cities. Between 2019-2020 and 2022-2023 school year, urban schools lost nearly 850,000 students, or 5.5% of enrollment, according to an analysis of the most recent federal data by the Brookings Institution, done at the Wall Street Journal's request. During that time, the number of school buildings has remained virtually unchanged, leaving more hollowed-out schools. Smaller schools can come with real benefits. In the early 2000s, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation supported the creation of small high schools with no more than 600 students in cities across the country. Research found that these schools helped more students to earn a diploma. But if schools get too small, they face a paradoxical problem. Costs per student tend to rise, but programming tends to shrink. With a critical mass of students, a school can afford a richer set of extracurricular activities and classes, and employ a greater array of staff, such as a nurse, librarian, and an art teacher. When schools get below a certain size threshold, they start facing these unique challenges that make it hard to deliver a high-quality education, said Joseph Trowick Smith, a consultant to school districts with the nonprofit Education Resource Strategies. Closing schools, though, is educationally and politically fraught. Families typically like their local schools and fear disruption to their child's education. Teachers don't want to lose their jobs. Community members worry closed schools will sit vacant and be a source of crime and blight. Everybody wants to keep their school because our schools are personal, said Janelle Foster, the former board chair of the St. Paul, Minnesota district. They become part of our family. They're our community. Foster voted in 2021 to close or merge several schools the district deemed unsustainably small. The closure decision sparked bitter protests. It was one of the hardest things I've had to do, Foster said. San Antonio Independent School District in Texas said in the fall that 15 schools will close next year. Money is being doled out unevenly because of the fixed costs needed to run a school, regardless of its enrollment. The smallest elementary school in San Antonio costs $14,041 per student, compared with $7,109 at the largest one. The only way to provide all the resources our kids need is by taking money from somewhere else, Superintendent Jamie Aquino said. Student mental health crises aren't timed to the one day a week a school has a counselor, he said, and teachers struggle to teach multi-grade classrooms necessitated by low enrollment. The district, where enrollment is down 29% from 1998, is pitching the community on the plans with the slogan, "Right-sizing with heart." We have been preparing for this as if we were going to the battlefield, Aquino said. He doubts this will be the last round of closures. In Inglewood, California, a largely black and Latino city just south of Los Angeles, a group of students walked out of classes at Morningside High School in April, despite threats of suspension, to protest the school's slated closure. They joined alumni and community activists on the sidewalk to rail against the recent announcement that five of the district's 16 schools will close or relocate by the end of next school year. It's part of our community. It's something generations of us have grown up with, said Evelyn Perez, a Morningside senior, as planes from nearby LAX airport roared overhead. Passing by and not seeing Morningside, it wouldn't even feel like Inglewood anymore. The school is down to 465 students from highs above 1,600 two decades ago. Alumna Carlos Bell, who attended in the 1980s alongside future NFL and WNBA athletes, said students shouldn't have to travel across the city to the schools that will remain open. They live right here, Bell said. They can walk home if they feel sick or don't have enough money for lunch. The protesters targeted their ire at James Morris, a white educator who was brought in last year as the district's eighth leader since the state took over Inglewood schools because of financial mismanagement in 2012. 3 miles away from the protest that day at the district office, Morris laid out the case for closures. Each closed elementary school will save around $500,000, he estimates. Students aren't well served, he said, at a high school with an empty pool and where the marching band uniforms donated by alumni go unused because there's no band director. This is about building something better for kids, said Morris, pointing to a Los Angeles Times article on the wall from 2000 about Inglewood Elementary reading scores far outpacing other economically disadvantaged districts in the state. He said he's trying to recapture that success and overcome the community's skepticism. Race plays a combustible role in these discussions. Schools with more students of color have historically been more likely to be closed, even accounting for other factors like enrollment, according to a recent national study. In 2013, Chicago's closure of 50 schools drew widespread opposition and has left lingering resentment. The backlash was credited with nearly toppling then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel in his 2015 re-election bid. A University of Chicago study later found students from closed schools lost ground academically. Enrollment at Chicago public schools dropped from about 400,000 in 2013 to 329,000 this year. This district, which is currently switching from a mayoral-run system to an elected school board, is under a moratorium on school closures. A spokesperson said district officials won't speculate on the possibility of closures, but that the district is evaluating the needs of its hundreds of campuses and provides extra funding to support small schools. In New York City, the country's largest school system has seen pre-K to 12th grade enrollment fall from over 1 million students in 2017 to under 900,000 this school year. Naquan McLean, president of a local education council in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, said the neighborhood is struggling with under-enrolled schools, including an elementary school with 54 students and a middle school with fewer than 100. "We don't have dance and art and music because we can't afford it," he said. New York City Schools Chancellor David Banks acknowledges this problem. "We have dozens of schools that are around 100 kids," he said. "You reach a point where it is so small that essentially you're doing a disservice to kids." While the city recently closed or merged a handful of small schools, it hasn't announced major restructuring plans. In Los Angeles, home to the nation's second largest school system, Superintendent Alberto Carvalho said he has been conveying a high-level sense of urgency around small schools. The district is down to 413,800 students across 800 schools from nearly 750,000 students at its peak in 2003. "At some point, we need to ask communities impacted, would you rather have three very old, significantly under-enrolled schools or one shiny Taj Mahal?" Cavallo said, "You cannot have three beautiful state-of-the-art schools that are all under-enrolled." Sparsely attended campuses would have been inconceivable in Los Angeles a few decades ago. From the 1980s to the early 2000s, Los Angeles Unified School District gained national notoriety for overcrowded schools. Students competed for desks in packed classrooms, and schools operated on year-round schedules. Some students boarded buses before dawn to head across the 710-square-mile district to schools with space. "It was just dreadful," said LAUSD School Board President Jackie Goldberg, who also served on the school board in the 1980s and early 90s. A massive building campaign followed, but by the time many of the schools opened, a decade or more later, charter schools were gaining popularity and district enrollment was starting to decline. Today, nearly 109,000 students in Los Angeles attend charter schools, which are publicly funded but run independently from the district. Hilda Salas Learning Academy, launched in 2012, with promises to house up to 600 students, never enrolled even 400. The Los Angeles School Board voted to close Salas in March and move a nearby engineering magnet program, which has lacked a permanent home and also suffered from enrollment loss, into the building next school year. Gutierrez, the last of the founding teachers still on the Salas staff, bristled when district employees recently implied they could have tried harder to increase enrollment. "The teachers did everything they could, hanging handmade banners, knocking on doors, sending mailers to middle school households, and hosting open houses." Mary Beltran, the parent of a senior, comes to Salas every morning to volunteer, carefully staping up new hallway displays and taking photos for the yearbook. She's seen the number of classes and clubs shrink since her older daughter graduated in 2019. "Salas could have been so much more," she said. Junior Juan Fausto has had friends leave the school for large campuses to join sports teams or junior ROTC programs. "We don't have the big events, but the one benefit we do have is we're more connected with the teachers," he said. He's wary of what will happen next year when students and staff from the magnet school, which has required student uniforms, take over the campus. Salas's closure is an exception in Los Angeles. Any consideration of large-scale school closures is at least a year away, Carvalho, the superintendent, said. Instead, the district is trying to attract families by rebranding neighborhood schools around a theme and staffing a hotline to help navigate enrollment, including a popular magnet school lottery. The district has even given LAUSD-themed swag bags to new mothers at some local hospitals. Enrollment losses slowed this year, Carvalho said, partly due to the expansion of a pre-kindergarten year for four-year-olds. Los Angeles and other cities, including New York and Chicago, have also seen an influx of migrant students, which has stabilized enrollment in all three cities for the first time in years. But an enrollment bounce back appears unlikely. LAUSD's own budget office projects further enrollment declines of under 3% a year for the next 2 years, and census data shows a dwindling number of young children in Los Angeles County. Similar declines have been seen elsewhere, as families with young children have left large cities and fertility rates have fallen nationally. The U.S. Department of Education projects that by the end of the decade, the nation's public schools, which currently educate nearly 50 million students, will lose another 2 million students. Marguerite Rosa, director of the Edunomics Lab, a school finance research center, said there is little districts can do about demographic shifts. At that point, it's like, all right, well, why don't you fix up young people and tell them to have more kids, she said. Los Angeles School Board member Tanya Ortiz Franklin said she wishes the board and district would address the challenge of small school head-on rather than holding out hope and treating school closures like a third rail. She has tallied 115 schools in the district that have 200 students or fewer. If we never talk about closing schools, we're keeping options from the next students who are coming in, Ortiz Franklin said. Our next story. Binance pledged to thwart suspicious trading until it involved a Lamborghini-loving high roller. This article is by Agnes Berwick and Elaine Yu. When the U.S. accused Binance last year of maximizing profits over protecting users, the company promised, quote, unceasing efforts to deliver a safe and trusted platform, close quotes. This was put to the test soon after, when an internal investigation found a top client, a firm run by a Lamborghini-loving crypto trader, was manipulating markets. The result? Binance kept the client and fired its investigator. The investigator and his colleagues on the company's market surveillance team had been hired from the traditional finance world to clean up Binance's act. The world's largest digital currency exchange, born in an unregulated freewheeling crypto culture, was under the microscope for allegedly failing to protect the sort of manipulative trading that would get Wall Street traders thrown in jail. Among the practices the surveillance team found, VIP clients, the largest on the exchange, engaged in a pump-and-dump schemes and wash trading that were explicitly prohibited in Binance's own terms of use, according to former company insiders and company documents. Binance also maintained a fleet of secret internal trading accounts that were used to trade large volumes of certain crypto tokens. Crypto exchanges such as Binance are at the center of the digital currency economy. Customers use them to trade one cryptocurrency for another, with Binance listing about 400 varieties, along with derivative products that allow users to bet on prices direction. The company says it has almost 190 million users, and industry data shows it processed spot and derivative trades worth over $4 trillion in March. The ex-company insiders say the investigators' dismissal in late 2023 showed that Binance, already in the crosshairs of the Security and Exchange Commission, neglected evidence of market manipulation and prioritized generating trading fees from large clients over fixing its practices. A fresh boom this year in crypto trading has created lucrative new trading opportunities for both Binance and its high-rolling customers. A Binance spokesperson said the company rejected any assertion that it has permitted market manipulation on the exchange and that it was prioritizing the improvement of compliance functions. We have a robust surveillance framework that identifies and takes action against market abuse, the spokesperson said. We do not favor any individual user, no matter how big, over the safety of the platform. Decisions to remove users weren't taken lightly and required sufficient evidence that they had breached the terms of use, the spokesperson said. A Binance executive said the company dismissed the investigator after a subsequent internal inquiry determined the claims against the client weren't fully substantiated. Last November, Binance pleaded guilty to violating U.S. anti-money laundering requirements and agreed to pay a $4.3 billion fine. Its founder, Changpeng Zhao, stepped down and was sentenced last week to 4 months in jail on a related charge. The exchange also faces civil charges in an SEC lawsuit. In a complaint last June, the SEC alleged Binance spun a web of deception and misleading U.S. investors about its risk controls to prevent manipulative trading. The SEC said Binance, along with its U.S. arm, put its own financial interests ahead of users. The SEC declined to comment. This article is based on interviews with former and current Binance employees as well as other industry players. The Wall Street Journal also reviewed key documents and emails. Aware of the SEC investigation back in 2022, Binance began growing the market surveillance team. It hired a dozen investigators from places such as Bank of America and hedge fund Citadel. The surveillance team built new software tools to track market manipulation and detect wash trading, which is when traders act as buyer and seller in the same transactions to create the illusion of an active market. The new tech opened investigators' eyes to the potential scale of the problem, particularly among the VIP clients that Binance's business relied on. Top traders, those trading more than $1 million a month, accounted for two-thirds of the platform's total trading volume last year. Investigators recommended booting out several hundred users through the first half of 2023 for violating the term of use. Their biggest action came last summer when they offboarded the Tron Foundation, a blockchain company set up by crypto entrepreneur Justin Sun, a friend of Binance founder Zhao. The SEC, in March 2023, charged the Tron Foundation and Sun with fraudulently manipulating the market for its own token through wash trading. Sun and the Tron Foundation, which have requested the case's dismissal, didn't respond to requests for comment. Team members also observed that Binance's own internal accounts were trading certain cryptocurrencies. They received no answer when they requested information inside Binance about who controlled them, the former company insiders said. The Commodities Futures Trading Commission, in a March 2023 complaint, warned that Binance wasn't disclosing to clients its own proprietary trading, which it said was being run by a quant desk and kept top secret. The Binance spokesperson said it doesn't trade for profit or manipulate the market under any circumstances, adding that its operations were under close scrutiny. Over the past 3 years, Binance has offboarded nearly 355,000 users with a transaction volume of more than $2.5 trillion for violations, this spokesperson said. A new VIP trader began to turn heads at Binance. DWF Labs, a trading and investment firm, vaulted into Binance's top VIP 9 designation, meaning it was making at least $4 billion in trades a month. Larger trading volumes on the exchange elevate clients' VIP ranking, giving them discounted trading fees and access to private relationship managers. DWF's Russian managing partner, Andrei Grachev, bragged about his riches last October on social media. "Get into the DWF Lambo," he tweeted with a photo of DWF-branded Lamborghini. Grachev, 36 years old, was formerly head of the Russian arm of crypto exchange HTX. He set up DWF in Singapore in 2022, corporate records show, and says he is based in Switzerland. DWF's role was a so-called market maker, a type of middleman firm that simultaneously buys and sells assets, usually indifferent to whether the price of the asset goes up or down. Market makers boost liquidity, making it easier for others to trade in and out of assets. They profit by pocketing the difference between the price they buy and sell at. In traditional finance, market makers must maintain this price neutrality under the rules of the exchange on which they operate. Binance didn't require market makers to sign any specific agreements that would govern their trading, allowing them largely to trade as they pleased, people familiar with the operation said. The Binance spokesperson said all users of the platform must adhere to its general terms of use that prohibit market manipulation. Instead of price neutrality, DWF offered to use its active trading position to drive up the prices of tokens and create what it called artificial volume on exchanges including Binance that would lure in other traders, according to proposals it sent to potential clients in 2022. In a report prepared that year for one customer, DWF wrote that it successfully generated artificial trading volume equal to 2/3 of the client's token and that it was working to produce a believable trading pattern. Other client proposals from last year said partnering with DWF would lead to bullish sentiment for their tokens. DWF and Grachev didn't respond to requests for comment. After this article was published, DWF said on X that allegations reported in the press are unfounded and distort the facts. DWF operates with the highest standards of integrity, transparency, and ethics, it said. Grachev told a crypto podcast last year that DWF wasn't manipulating markets and questioned whether any trader could. Maybe it could happen once, right? But again and again, continuously, it's not possible, he said. The Binance spokesperson said that they were unaware of these DWF documents. If true, it would be very concerning to us and other participants, the spokesperson said. A company that DWF said it invested in was Yield Guild Games. The Swiss-registered crypto startup agreed to sell $10 million worth of its token to DWF, about a quarter of its market capitalization at the time. The value soared fivefold last August after Binance listed a highly leveraged derivative contract tied to the YGG token. Grachev had touted YGG on X just before, claiming the listing would bring the token sustainability and power. Its price plummeted soon after. The crypto industry took notice of the volatility, with two other market-making firms privately raising concerns about DWF with Binance. One of these market makers complained about DWF's trading to Binance's department that handled VIP clients, which in turn connected the company with the market surveillance team. Based on this referral, the team began an investigation into DWF that September. Binance's investigators found that DWF manipulated the price of YGG and at least six other tokens and made over $300 million in wash trades in 2023, concluding these were violations of the terms of use, according to some of the former company's insiders. Following Grachev's tweet promoting YGG, DWF sold almost 5 million of the tokens in two batches near the peak, triggering the collapse, they said. YGG's co-founder Gabby Dizon said he wasn't aware of the investigation's findings. The surveillance team submitted its report recommending DWF's removal later in September. Over the next few days, the head of Binance's VIP client department and her staff questioned the findings and complained to the company's leadership. Another Binance department, tasked with assessing employees' compliance, launched its own investigation, this time into the market surveillance team and the evidence they had compiled on DWF. The new inquiry determined that there was insufficient evidence of DWF engaging in market abuse, the Binance executive said. The wash trades identified by the surveillance team could have been accidental, so-called self-trades, that may not alone amount to manipulative behavior, it found. Binance, the executive said, also felt the surveillance team's head had collaborated too closely on the case with the DWF competitor who made the original complaint. Company leaders then rejected the surveillance team's offboarding request. A week after the DWF's report submission, they fired the team's head. Binance laid off several more investigators over the next following months, which the Binance executive attributed to cost-saving measures. Others quit voluntarily. The Binance executive said the team is about the same size today. Our next story. Hospitals are refusing to do surgeries unless you pay in full first. This article is by Melanie Evans. Heather Mycone had 7 weeks to come up with $2,000 to pay for surgery her daughter needs to breathe more easily. Merritt Island Surgery Center in Merritt Island, Florida, billed Mycone in advance of the adenoid and tonsil surgery. If she can't pay for the surgery before it is scheduled to take place next month, the procedure will be put off. Mycone, whose insurance won't cover the cost because she has a high deductible, works three jobs and doesn't have the savings to cover the cost. She is now appealing to strangers through a GoFundMe campaign for help. For years, hospitals and surgery centers waited to perform procedures before sending bills to patients. that often left them chasing after patients for payment, repeatedly sending invoices and enlisting debt collectors. But now, more hospitals and surgery centers are demanding patients pay in advance. Advanced billing helps the facilities avoid hounding patients to settle up. Yet it is distressing patients who must come up with thousands of dollars while struggling with serious conditions. Those who can't come up with the sums have been forced to put off procedures. Some who paid up discovered later they were overcharged and then had to fight for refunds. Among the procedures that hospitals and surgery centers are seeking prepayments for are knee replacements, CT scans, and births. Merritt Island first provided Mycone an estimate of $3,000 for treatment for her daughter, Krista Churchwell. It then lowered the estimate to $2,000 because she had already paid down some of her deductible. When she got the first estimate, Mycone figured there's no way she would be able to afford the procedure. Mycone, who lives with her daughter in Merritt Island, processes medical records, delivers food on weekends, and helps cater meals to make a living. "I can't even provide for my daughter to get surgery for her to be able to breathe," she recalled feeling. The surgery would improve her daughter's breathing by reducing obstructions such as adenoids, tonsils, and bony nose structures called turbinates. Merritt Island Surgery Center is jointly owned by physicians and SCA Health, a subsidiary of United Health, Health Services arm Optum. Before providing care, Merritt Island Surgery Center engages each of our patients individually to ensure they understand their potential out-of-pocket costs and are aware of available no-cost financing options, the center said. Federal law requires hospitals to take care of people in an emergency. Hospitals say they don't turn away patients who need medical care urgently for lack of prepayment. Some 23% of what patients owe is collected by hospitals before treatment, according to an analysis of first quarter data this year from 1,850 hospitals by Kodiak Solutions, a healthcare consulting and software company. For the same period in 2022, the figure was 20%. They are seeking advance payment for non-emergencies, they say, because chasing unpaid bills is challenging and costly. Roughly half the debt hospitals wrote off last year was owed by patients with insurance, the Kodiak analysis found. "We need these patients who are able to pay to do so," said Leslie Taylor, a spokeswoman for the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, which owns one general hospital in Arkansas, and will, after discussing with doctors, reschedule some procedures until patients can pay. For patients, the hospitals say, knowing the cost ahead of service gives them the opportunity to comparison shop and avoid getting walloped with a huge bill unexpectedly. Patients often want to know in advance what their medical care will cost. Congress and regulators in recent years have ordered hospitals to be more transparent on prices, which vary widely, and to limit surprise billing. Still, finding money for treatment is a challenge for many American households. Half of adults say they can't afford to spend more than $500 on medical care should they be suddenly sick or injured. A survey by health policy nonprofit KFF found they would need to borrow. In addition, determining how much a patient will owe can be tricky. How much each patient pays depends on their health plan, its deductible, or other out-of-pocket costs, and prices the plan negotiated with the hospital to pay. Blake Young was overcharged nearly $2,500 by CHI Memorial Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee, ahead of a heart screening last year. The hospital initially said he owed about $3,600 and asked for payment. He paid up front using funds stocked away in his health savings account. When he arrived for the testing, the hospital gave him a new bill saying he owed less. Young, 59 years old, an industrial machinery salesman who lives in Chattanooga, said he didn't get a refund check that the hospital said it mailed in late December. The next month, Young filed a complaint with the Better Business Bureau. In February, CHI Memorial agreed to reissue the check. In April, the hospital wrote in a letter to Young that it had failed to reissue the check because of a communication error. The hospital also apologized to Young for the delay. CHI Memorial is committed to helping patients understand and afford the cost of their health care, a spokeswoman said. The hospital overbilled Young because of an administrative error and issued a refund, she said. CHI Memorial, which is owned by one of the nation's largest Catholic health systems, Common Spirit Health, will go ahead with procedures without advance payment, a spokesman said. Young got the hospital's $2,546 refund check Tuesday. He wanted the money back for future medical bills. It's not unlimited funds, he said. They do run out. Our next story. When did minor league baseball get raunchy? This article is by Patrick Coffey. The Burlington Sock Puppets, the Rocket City Trash Pandas, the Savannah Bananas, and their life-size fruit mascot, Split. Amateur and semi-pro baseball teams are often in left field when choosing names, logos, and mascots to attract attention and fill seats. But the one-upsmanship reached newly libidinous levels in February when Danville, Virginia, celebrated a new team in the local collegiate summer league, the Danville Dairy Daddies. The name pays homage to Southern Virginia's dairy trade, and its mascot, McCreamy, is a hunky, virile bull with a come-hither look, tight jeans, and little else. We did want an air of sensuality, said Austin Scher, the Dairy Daddy's general manager. We wanted McCreamy to be the ideal. If I play my cards right, that could be my partner, boyfriend, husband, whatever. The Daddy's social media accounts teem with enough double entendre to make a milkmaid blush, including, if you build it, they will cream, accompanied by an image of McCreamy posing among swooning heifers. Coming ballpark promotions include Teat Tuggin' Thursday. I am uncomfortable, but I love this team so much, as one fan put it. Within 37 hours of the Daddy's debut, merchandise orders flooded in from all 50 states and overseas, according to Scher. Local resident Maureen Belko fielded queries about the Daddies from her out-of-state siblings. My family in New Jersey, they're like, Maureen, can you explain this? Said Belko. I'm like, I cannot, but do you want a t-shirt? Regional teams have used creative branding to drum up attention since at least 1899, when the Wheeling, West Virginia Mountaineers became the Stogies to honor the area's cigar rolling industry. When you're a minor league baseball team, you kind of have to cheat. You don't have million-dollar ad budgets, said Jason Klein, co-founder of branding firm Brandios. But as the Silly Sobriquet competition heats up, teams have inched closer and closer to the foul line. Many have gone so far as to develop alternative identities, playing under different outlandish names for a few games each season. Some teams have flirted with sexual innuendo unintentionally. Earlier this year, the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes, an LA Dodgers affiliate, renamed themselves the Chaquitas as part of minor league baseball's campaign to attract more Hispanic fans. That moniker heralded Dodgers star Joe Kelly's decision to wear a mariachi jacket during a 2021 White House visit. Only later did the team realize, through social media chatter, that Chiquita is in some quarters slang for masturbation. After consulting with members of the Hispanic community, the Chiquitas decided to embrace a new identity, according to Executive Vice President and General Manager Grant Riddle. I think all that stuff is just a footnote to the story, he says. You can put anything into the Urban Dictionary, and you know, you might find a not suitable for work connotation. The Eugene, Oregon Emeralds, a San Francisco Giants affiliate, struggled during the pandemic, but tripled merchandise sales to nearly $1 million last season by rebranding as the Exploding Whales, said General Manager Alan Benavides. That name is a nod to the notorious 1970s blunder in which a dead, smelly 8-ton sperm whale washed ashore in Oregon. The state highway agency decided it would be a fine idea to use explosives to blast the carcass to smithereens and let seagulls take care of the remains. Instead, the beach erupted in a 100-foot-high column of sand and whale, reported the Register Guard. Chunks of the animal flew in every direction, and spectators began to scream and run for cover. A parked car more than a quarter mile from the blast was smashed by falling blubber. as a local KATU reporter said at the time, the blast blasted blubber beyond all believable bounds. The first batch of Exploding Whales baseball team apparel sold out in 90 seconds, attracting collectors from as far afield as Australia and Japan. It saved our season, said Benavides. The Rocket City Trash Pandas of Madison, Alabama, adopted an identity that combines nearby Huntsville's aerospace nickname with slang for garbage-gobbling raccoons. They have since led the minor leagues in moving merchandise, racking up more than $4 million in sales before playing their first game in 2021, according to Executive Vice President Lindsay Knupp. The Dairy Daddies were born when Danville and entrepreneurs, who had already launched the Otterbots Summer League collegiate team in 2021, decided to double their fund by creating a second team, leveraging their existing stadium lease. In 2023, they threw a curveball to Studio Simon, a Louisville design firm specializing in minor and collegiate league baseball teams. They sought a complete brand identity based on a long-contemplated name and their vision of a beefy cleanup hitter who happens to be bovine. At first, I was thinking about dad jeans. I was thinking this is a guy with a little bit of a gut, recalls Studio Simon founder Dan Simon. Not quite. They were specific. No, it isn't that kind of a daddy, Simon says. This is a who's your daddy kind of daddy. Cher said McCreamy is genderless, as most mascots are. The Bush Leaguer is named after Patrick Dempsey's Grey's Anatomy character, and the team hopes he, or it, can strike a balance between family-friendly icon and provocateur. When we shared Field of Creams, we knew we had to watch the comments, said Cher. The Daddies recently introduced a hashtag Daddies After Dark on X, sharing a follower's 50 Shades of Hay pun and teasing all the dairy baddies be sliding into the DMs tonight. Everybody believes it to be all in good fun, says Danville City Manager Kenneth Larking. He hopes the team might draw out-of-state visitors who could be seduced by Danville's charms and soon-to-be-finished Caesar's Virginia Hotel and Casino. He does, however, add, I think they really pushed the envelope on trying to stand out. We turn now to articles in U.S. news. Stormy Daniels grilled on Money Madoff Trump story and experience with ghosts. This article is by Corinne Ramey and Aaron Mulvaney. Donald Trump's lawyer on Thursday sought to portray porn star Stormy Daniels as a fabulist who speaks to ghosts and a hustler who had made millions off her years-old story of sex with the former president. Suzanne Nichols rattled off how Daniels had made money on a $130,000 hush money payment, a book, hashtag steamy stormy merchandise, and a strip club tour called Make America Horny Again, advertised with a photo of her and Trump. She noted that Daniels, 45 years old, had written and directed about 150 sex films. You have a lot of experience in making phony stories about sex appears to be real, right? Nichols asked. Daniels said she wouldn't put it that way. But if she had made up the encounter with Trump, she said, it would have been a lot better. And that will conclude our articles, a reading of articles from the Wall Street Journal for Friday, May 10th, 2024. For Radio Reading Services, this is Greg Salins wishing you a great day.